This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
The experts at Web.com want to build your business a successful website for free. Plus, we'll promote it on all the major search engines. If after 30 days you're happy, we'll continue to provide promotion, hosting, support, and maintenance, all for one low monthly fee. If not, cancel and pay nothing. Call right now and you'll also get a free .com or .net domain name for your new website, powered by VeriSign, the world's leading domain name provider.
Call 800-215-0465. That's 800-215-0465.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. We are commencing Freestyle Friday, which is just oh so exciting for me. Much of the media is upset. Oh, wait, before I get into the freestyle, the phone lines are, of course, wide open because it is Friday. And that means the number is, as always, 888-900-3393. We have a couple of guests today, but not too many. And let me know, by the way, on Facebook. I'm wondering if we've been doing more guests recently. I'm curious to know if you guys... I want to know what you think. I want to know what the team, which is you, what you think sort of the sweet spot is for guests. Two a day? Three a day? One? You tell me. Kind of curious to know what your thoughts are on that. So Facebook.com/Buck Sexton is the best place to give me those comments. Or you could call in. We could talk about it on air. So rather than do what everybody else is doing, because I try to avoid that here because, well, everyone else is doing it. It's not that interesting. I wanted to talk to you today about a piece that I think should get more attention than it did. It's very, very instructive, beyond even just the case study that it was used for. I think it's fascinating. So, generally speaking, when I think something's fascinating, the response I get from you all is that you at least like it or you find it an interesting subject matter. And this is in my wheelhouse, right? Because when I was CIA CTC, which is I throw out that acronym a lot. So obviously, you know, CIA, CTC is the Counterterrorism Center. And I was specifically in the, obviously, although I shouldn't say that because there were other non-Al-Qaeda groups that were part of CTC's portfolio. But I was dealing with Al-Qaeda in CTC. So that was what I was brought into in the agency. And then I kind of moved into working on Iraq, but specifically what we called Sunni insurgency, which was really, and within that, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI. Even though Al-Qaeda in Iraq became a breakaway organization under Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a breakaway from mainstream Al-Qaeda. And that had to do with the decision that Zarqawi had made to focus on the creating a civil war between Sunni, which, of course, hardline Sunni Muslims believe it. That's the only kind of Muslim, right? That Shia are Rafida, rejectionists. They are essentially heretics within the Muslim faith. And by the way, that Sunni Shia civil war is playing out now across the Middle East. We talk about it with some regularity here in the HUD. It's a conflict that's going on in Iraq. It's a conflict that's playing out in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Syria, you name it. It's something that is now really, and of course, with Iran and Saudi Arabia squaring off against each other as the primary regional powers. Interesting that there would have been a time, I think, not long ago when Egypt would have been considered really the primary Sunni Arab power, just from a military perspective, because of its relationship with America and under Mubarak. And now the Saudis have sort of surpassed them as the main Sunni Arab state in terms of, you know, regional dominance. Even though the Saudis have obviously had a lot more cash for a long time. Egypt was sort of the Sunni Arab country, and now really we think of the Saudis as the Sunni Arab country from a geopolitics perspective. But this is a little bit separate from or a little bit of a digression from what I want to talk to you about, because I mentioned CTC, and part of the training we go through there and indoctrination process, indoc, I mean, when they bring you in and sort of teach you all CIA stuff, it's just a lot of background reading and a lot of reading on the high side on the classified side about previous things, right? You need to learn sort of the backstories of different areas. And one of the things that I always found to be fascinating was looking at when a terrorist group pops up in a certain, when a jihadist group becomes really prominent, it never comes out of nothing. Right? It never emerges out of some vacuum. Oh my gosh. I mean, all of a sudden there are people that say they want to go wage jihad in some foreign land, or they want to wage jihad at home. All of a sudden they want to blow themselves up. They want to strap on a suicide vest. I mean, think about that mentality, by the way. You're going to strap on a vest that's going to blow you up and everyone around you. Complete strangers, people you've never met. How can you convince anyone to do that? I've always thought that Christopher Hitchens' line on this is an essential one, which is that you can talk about external factors. You can talk about hopelessness, about despair, about poverty. But when you're really looking at radicalization in the context of jihad, that portion of Muslims within Islam... and it's far too large a portion. It may be small numerically, but it's far too large a portion because it is the most disruptive force right now for security and social and I would argue economic and political progress in the world. Whatever contingent of the Muslim faith is responsible for this, I leave to others to tell me what the numbers are. But the contingent is large enough that it's causing more problems than any other single identifiable political or religious factor that I can think of. Right. Not long ago, I would have said it was communism, Marxism, socialism, as the communists would have referred to it themselves, by the way. They would often talk about being socialists. Now we've had a sort of rebranding of socialists with democratic socialists across Europe, and now even with Bernie Sanders getting a substantial portion of Democrats in this country to believe that there's nothing wrong with socialism at all, even if it's openly discussed and talks about really confiscatory policies. But anyway, back to the radicalization. So I always found the looking at the purposes. Oh, the precondition, by the way. Sorry, Hitchens. I'm bouncing around a lot, I know. So I'll try to stay on task here because there's a lot I want to talk to you about. Hitchens would say that the precondition for being a suicide bomber was belief in Islam. I mean, that was sort of that was a thing you needed first and foremost, right? It's sort of like if you're creating an explosive device, and some of you I know, I probably have some EOD techs listening to the show, I would guess. I know I've got a lot of military listening to the show, which is all of you, by the way, do me great honor by listening and downloading. And every time I get a message from somebody, I get a message who's ever been downrange, sometimes even people who are still downrange in Iraq or Afghanistan. It actually makes my day. I got a real special, it's a real honor and a compliment, but I'd be willing to bet that there's an EOD tech listening to the show right now. And somebody who specializes in explosives and disposal of explosives, dealing with explosives, making sure that they don't go off or in some context, building them themselves. They'll tell you that, you know, there's some things you need, right? You need some sort of a substance that is actually the material for these. Like, yeah, you need wires and there's other stuff too, right? I mean, I've played with C4 and I should say played with, but you know, I always think back to the Bill Murray scenes in Caddyshack where he's got C4, which we call some people also call plastic explosives. I think that goes back to the OSS days in the Second World War when we were hoping that the French, la résistance, the French would engage in sabotage behind Nazi lines, and some of the packaging that we would send them of what is C4 said on it, explosive plastique, and that's where we get plastic explosives from. But I've handled plastic explosives for some period of time, spent some time with them, and without a detonator and without the proper additions to it, there's really not much that you can do with it, right? It's actually very stable. I mean, I wouldn't recommend anybody ever do this, but you can sort of form little animals out of it like Bill Murray does it's very sort of malleable. I mean, it's also very toxic. You want to wash it off if you get it on your fingers. But you need a detonator for it to go. It's not like some other – and detonators freak me out. I mean, I remember actually working with detonators and – they would show you photos of what happens when people don't, because they're tiny. I mean, they're the blasting caps. I mean, they don't look like much. And they would show us, as it was very effective, by the way, they show us what happens when people don't respect this tiny, it looks like almost, it's like the size of, you know, a pen cap or something. And they show you what happens if you don't take them seriously and people lose fingers. So, or worse. But that's the precondition. You need explosive material to make an explosive, and the precondition for being a suicide bomber is you need a belief in jihadization. You need some sort of religious sanction. The people say, oh, Buck, what about the kamikaze? I'd say, well, kamikaze, the divine wind, a reference actually to the abortive invasion of the Japanese mainland by the Mongol horde, by the way. The Mongols were going to invade via ships, of course, because Japan's an island, pretty obvious, Buck. But there was a big storm, a typhoon, if you will, and it destroyed much of the fleet. And they call that the divine wind, and it saved it probably did save mainland Japan from being part of the Mongol Empire and forever changed. Then later on, kamikaze was used, of course, Second World War. And we're going to talk about Obama and Hiroshima shortly. But in the context of people who are engaged in sort of suicide missions. So I'm not saying that only, you know, of course, there have been fanatics who will die for the cause for a long time. The original, if you go back to the original zealots, for example, they were Jewish extremists in the first century. So they tried to rebel against the Roman Empire. And so the original zealots were sort of Jews who were willing to die for the faith, fight and die for the faith. That's where we get the term from. What was I saying? Oh, yes. We're talking about the ground, sort of the how does a place become fertile ground for extremism? And it's a fascinating discussion. And you have people, and I've come across some of them on TV. Some are did discuss this in good faith, and others are, quite honestly, just apologists for terrorists. And it's disgusting. And I think they should be openly, verbally maligned and not a part of this discussion, because they really do just want to blame America and make excuses for the worst kinds of sadism and pretend that none of this has anything to do with Islam. I'm not saying it has all of Islam has to do with it, but certainly some of it does. And as I said, it's the precondition. It's the explosive material needed for the rest of the device. Without the explosive material, you can't have an explosive, right? Without C4, no, you don't get a boom. At least not a boom worthy of anything. So everything else, poverty, despair, etc., consider that to be that's the wiring. That's the timer. That's the detonator. That's the blasting cap. That's the accelerant. But you need belief. You need jihadist belief in order to get to the point where you're willing to be a suicide bomber, we're willing to wage jihad. And so when we're talking about how that happens in a country and in a society, there's a very interesting piece. And we will I'll post it. You can read it in full on Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. It's about how this happened in a place that was otherwise very pro-American. And it happened very quickly. How a tiny country in Europe, a recently recognized country, we should point out, wasn't really a country, and then it kind of became one because of what happened. Kosovo. How Kosovo went from being, according to the polling, one of the most pro-American countries in the world, largely because we saved them, right? And we can get into that on the other side of the break. How does a country go from, in 1999, when the war ends there, having the U.S. favorability rate in Kosovo? I mean, you look at U.S. favorability in France, and it's like 40% of the French like Americans, maybe 50%, maybe sometime. I don't know. I can't tell. Very smelly Americans. And you looked at the numbers for a place like Kosovo, and it was like 96% of Kosovars liked us. 98%. Albania, another country, very pro-American, really love Americans. How do you get a country that, call it 15 years ago or so, was overwhelmingly pro-American, has now turned into, per capita, the single most fertile place in Europe for jihadist recruitment into ISIS and into the various other movements of radical Islamic terrorism? How does that happen? Well, I think by going into that process, we have a much better understanding for how it happens anywhere. We also get a better sense of who the enemy is, who we're fighting. And it sheds light on this debate and this discussion where there is a constant effort to obfuscate, to muddy the waters, to make sure that we cannot have clarity on not who, not just whom we are fighting. With whom are we fighting? Who's the enemy? Question that needs to be answered. But also, how do they become the enemy? What happens? The very short answer, by the way, well, of course, as I said before, the precondition, the necessary first step, the necessary ingredient for this is belief. Belief in jihad is being a Muslim is a necessary step in this process. It's not alone enough, but a belief in jihad is the step beyond that. And how does that get pushed? What is the accelerant into that process? Well, the short answer is Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. I'll have to give you more details about this on the flip side. Sponsor this half hour is GoTenna. Look, we're talking about jihad. As you know, terrorist attacks can hit anywhere. And when they do, the whole grid can go down. And all of a sudden now, communication with loved ones can be the difference between life and death. And there's a whole bunch of emergencies where the comms can go down. All of a sudden, cell towers are no good. If it's a natural disaster, can't count on cells. If it's just something where everyone's all of a sudden trying to get on the same cell tower at the same time, your phone becomes useless. Also, sometimes you're just out of range. What if you're in an area that just happens to be a dark spot? There's nothing you can do. Your phone is useless. You can't allow your phone to become a dead communication device. GoTenna saves you from that. GoTenna does what cell networks can't. It turns your iOS or Android phone into an off-the-grid communication tool. It allows you to send text messages and critical GPS location information to any other GoTenna in your range. Think of it like a high-tech digital walkie-talkie. You can send along information, allow you to communicate, and it just has to be point-to-point within range. The setup is easy. All you have to do is download the app to your phone and you pair it wirelessly over Bluetooth. For a limited time now, GoTenna is offering an exclusive discount for listeners of this show. You can receive $10 off a pair of GoTennas and $20 off a family pack of four when you use the offer code BUCK at checkout. Go to buckgotenna.com right now after the special offer or for the special offer. Don't wait until you're unable to communicate with loved ones. Take action. buckgotenna.com. Offer code BUCK. We'll be right back.
Buck Sexton. Dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
The experts at Web.com want to build your business a successful website for free. Plus, we'll promote it on all the major search engines. If after 30 days you're happy, we'll continue to provide promotion, hosting, support, and maintenance, all for one low monthly fee. If not, cancel and pay nothing. Call right now and you'll also get a free .com or .net domain name for your new website, powered by VeriSign, the world's leading domain name provider.
Call 800-215-0465. That's 800-215-0465.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
Tim, the phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. Let's chat a bit, shall we? But I need to get back into this discussion about this. And this has been on my mind for a couple of reasons, by the way. One is this piece in the Times that it's good. I mean, look, they have smart people working at the New York Times. I don't always think that, I mean, I think that they're much more liberal than they realize. I don't think the editorial board is honest. And I think that they do a lot of propaganda for the Democratic Party, but they have good writers and they're intelligent. I'm not going to pretend that's not the case. And they can do some very good reporting on some issues. Now, the way that they frame it and the, you know, that you've got to sort of always read between the lines. But there was that piece, which I'm talking about now, about how Kosovo became a launch pad for, or I should say a recruiting ground for jihadists. Well, it's both. It's a launch pad and a recruiting ground. But why would Kosovo, a country that loved America so much? And that's also important to point that out, by the way, in all the jihadist propaganda, you never hear about how we really went to war twice in the 90s or engaged in sort of military interventions. I mean, we were mostly air campaign or really entirely air campaign in the case of what happened in the Balkans. But we went to war a couple of times to save embattled Muslim minorities from genocide. You don't hear that. Right. That's never that somehow is always America is so evil. And you look at MSNBC and these people, oh, terrorism is because of U.S. actions. I'm just wondering, do we ever get any credit for that? Does anyone ever care about the fact that we dropped bombs on Christian Serbs, by the way, to save ethnic Albanian Muslims in the case of Kosovo, or we can go back to Bosnia? No, we don't get credit for that, really. Or we don't get any, nope, doesn't really come up, does it? Because we're so hateful and evil, America. That's what the left believes in this country, and that's what the jihadists around the world believe. But the story of how Kosovo became a fertile recruiting ground for jihad is a fascinating one, and we're going to hit it on the flip side of this break. Stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
So go back to 1999. You have a U.S. air campaign that has essentially saved or tried to save, intervened on behalf of Kosovar's ethnic Albanians who live in Kosovo. And, you know, I mean, like I was in high school at the time. It's a state that was recognized as independent from Serbia only starting back in 2008. So it's the sort of newest European country. Not the newest country in the world, though. I think that title goes to South Sudan, which had to be separated after a vicious civil war that dragged on for years and years. Anyway, it's Kosovo. What ended up happening there? What this piece talks about, I was thinking about this on a few levels. One is because of this New York Times piece. Also because I went to this Cato Milton Friedman Award dinner earlier in the week, and the honoree was the individual responsible for publishing the Danish cartoons, which resulted in embassies being attacked and burned and all kinds of mayhem and chaos around the world, which in a whole bunch of Muslim countries gives you a sense of what we're dealing with here. It's not just people within the faith who are expected to adhere to Islamic norms under threat of force and under possible pain of death. It's all the rest of us, too. It's non-believers as well, which is sort of unique, I have to say. It's certainly unique in the modern context. You know, you don't see a lot of Christians walking around expecting Hindus to stop being polytheists and stop their idolatry, you know, and if they don't, we're going to go harm them, right? That would be any Christian that you know, I'm sure, would say that's insane. Leave them alone. Let them do whatever they want. And all the Hindus I know in this country are like very nice, peaceable, decent, wonderful citizens. Like don't bother them. What's wrong with you, right? I mean, that would be the attitude. Regardless. Ethnic Albanians saved by the U.S., as I said, a very pro-American population for obvious reasons at that point in time. And then the Saudis came in. And this is, as I've called it before, and I've written about this or written this out at least, tweeted about this, the Saudi playbook. And this is what they've done in country after country. I saw it myself in a country in West Africa, in which I had some interesting adventures that one day I hope to be allowed to tell you about. I'd have to sort of do some checking with some of the folks down in D.C. as to how much I can talk about. But I did spend time not just in the Middle East and South Asia, but also in West Africa back in the day, and saw some very interesting things. One of the things that I became aware of was the extent and the very deep reach of Saudi money. And it's a pretty straightforward process. What they do is they look for places where there's a Muslim community that is in a very desperate circumstance, whether it's through poverty or otherwise. But the best one is through some form of warfare, right? Either there's been a war or there's some ongoing sectarian struggle of some kind, or there has been in recent memory or one is simmering. But they look for that. So they look for a Muslim population that either has suffered terribly or is currently embattled. And what the Saudis do, and this is not necessarily, some of this is, you start to get into, well, how much of this is official state policy? How much of this are Saudi institutions that the state turns a blind eye to? And also, by the way, it's really the Arabian Peninsula is a better way to think of this, although Yemen doesn't really have the funds and is not really a part of this. But it's all these rich oil states, right? As I've said, the sort of glorified gas station countries of, the UAE and those are the places that when we're talking about money being sent for the purpose for what we're talking about here, it comes from Saudi Arabia, it comes from the UAE, maybe some of it comes from Bahrain, maybe some of it comes from some other small statelets. But more or less, that's what we're talking about, right? So the Arabian Peninsula, Arabia, because of its gas money, oil money, hydrocarbon money, gas money, it sounds like, hey, I got a 20, but sends money all over the world, but with a very specific purpose. And it's proselytizing, but it's a very specific kind of proselytizing. It's the proselytizing of what people refer to as Wahhabi Islam. And I've talked to you before about Wahhabism, right? Ibn Abdul Wahhab, the 18th century preacher who made a deal with the sort of Arabian warlord who would become the House of Saud. And through accidents of history and then the discovery of oil, and very unfortunate for the world that this is the way it went down. But now you have really the richest Muslim country is the one that has the most virulent. And it's also, of course, the birthplace of Islam. And it's also the holding place of the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina. But it is the country that has the most virulent, destructive and dangerous strain of Islamic belief. And it is a strain. Maybe it's not the only strain. Of course, it's not the only strain, right? People say, well, what about Indonesia, Buck, and Malaysia and the peaceable Muslim? Okay, fine. But Wahhabi Islam is a strain of Islam, to be sure. And it has been spread like a virus from Saudi Arabia. And the case of Kosovo, as detailed in this New York Times piece, is one of the prime examples of what happens when Saudi money is allowed to infiltrate into a downtrodden, violated, down on its luck, suffering society. And now, granted, this was after the war. I mean, you could argue that there's only so much mosque building you can do during the war, of course, right? But they did a lot of mosque building afterwards. In fact, in this piece, they say that Kosovo has over 800. Kosovo is a small place in terms of overall population. Talking about less than 2 million people. Okay, so it's a quarter the size of New York City. Think about it in those terms. Of New York City. This is a country. It's a quarter the size of New York City by population. It's maybe the size of, what is it? Is it like the size of Chicago? So there are 800 mosques. That's a lot of mosques. Over 800 mosques. But of those 800, 240 of them have been built since the war. Who built those mosques? Where did Kosovo get all this money to build all the hundreds of new mosques? I'm sure they're giant and shiny and new. The Saudis and the Emiratis and a few others. They sent checks, but they don't just send checks to build the mosque. They also then supply the imams. And these imams show up. And what kind of Islam do you think they preach? Do you think they're going over there and talking about how, oh, we need to live in peace and harmony with other religions of the world? No, of course not. They say that all the problems of the world are due to a rejection of the true Islam, which is the original Salafist Islam, right? Salaf meaning forefathers. It sort of means forefathers in Arabic. And so Salafism is really, Wahhabism is a kind of Salafism, if you will. There are others as well. There are other hardliners. There's like Deobandi Islam in Pakistan, which is also a hardline school of Islam. But Wahhabism is a strain of Salafism, and Salafism is, let's go back to the way it was in the 7th century with Muhammad and then the so-called rightly guided caliphs, Rashidun, who came after Muhammad. And, of course, this is all Sunni, right? This doesn't include the Shia rejectionists, the Rafida, who were partisans of Ali, which is where we get the whole term Shiite, Shia Ali, Shia partisans of Ali. So this is what ends up happening. They start building all these mosques in Kosovo. Remember, Kosovo, America rides in, saves the day. Yay, America. We love America. Do you think that this wouldn't be a particularly easy place to just sort of show up and all of a sudden convince people that they should join an organization that is at war with America and wants to kill Americans and Europeans and all non-believers and even some believers, by the way, under the doctrine of takfir, which allows Muslims to declare other Muslims outside of the faith. Right, so you call someone a takfiri, it's essentially saying they're a heretic, right? This is similar to when Christians in the medieval period, which was a long time ago, and, you know, life expectancy was like 45 or 40 or something, and it's different. I don't like this argument. People say, oh, well, look what Christians did 500 years ago. It's like, well, yeah, it was 500 years ago. Things were a little different then. I'm not sure that, I think you've already conceded the argument. If you're going to say, well, Islam's not that bad, because look at what Christians were doing, look at the Inquisition. That was a while ago. We've learned some things since then. Humanity has progressed, dare I say, or at least a lot of us have. But I digress. So the Saudis come in, they build the mosques, and they, of course, also provide social services. This is kind of the Hezbollah model as well, right? With Hezbollah, it's like come for the soup, stay for the jihad. That's the way that they did things in Kosovo. They would set up the mosque and they'd provide these imams, and they'd also provide some social services and provide education. And then they start setting up the schools. And always remember this, the hardline Muslims, they always want control of the schools. Even in fact, in the book by Michel Houellebecq that I've recommended to you before, the French novelist Submission, he just talks about that's all they want. Once they have enough power in European countries, the first ministry they'll want control of is the Ministry of Education, because they understand. They're like progressives in this country. You just need to indoctrinate people young, and then you've already got them. Forget about controlling, oh, I need to control this ministry and that ministry later. If you control the education ministry, you control everything. And so then they set up the schools, and all of a sudden you have people who are going into school who are getting, maybe it's just religious education. Sometimes perhaps it's a little more than that, but religion is the primary focus, and the indoctrination process occurs. And this has led to a situation where you have per capita more, after the Saudis have come in and built all these mosques, you have per capita more Kosovars who are going to fight with ISIS in terms of the number. Remember, there's only 2 million people, and talking about some of these other European states, there's tens of millions of people, but a pretty significant number of them have radicalized. Over the last 2 years alone, there have been 314 Kosovars, including 2 suicide bombers, 48 women and 28 children, who have gone to join the Islamic State, which is the highest number per capita in all of Europe. So it's interesting because you look at Libya and Tunisia that have the unfortunate distinction of two of the most prolific recruiting grounds for suicide bombers in Iraq, right? So people from particularly Derna in eastern Libya, an important city for those of you who are interested in the history of the Barbary Wars, which I do promise one day I will get to the Barbary Wars podcasts, but not today. I still have to make them. And in Tunisia, where you would think, because Tunisia tends to be a relatively moderate state from the perspective of it, you know, it has been pro-Western in the past, and but a lot of Tunisians have gone to join the Islamic State as well. In Europe, the Kosovars have been joining in substantial numbers, hundreds of people. And remember, for every 300 Kosovars that goes to join the Islamic State, how many do you think are considering it? How many do you think assisted or encouraged those 300 to go? This is where you start to go beyond cell, which is operational, active terrorist, terrorists in a group that are working together, to the cluster, which is how we used to refer to those sort of around them who are either a spiritual sanctioner or just helping with sort of logistics, or, you know, the people that are enablers, really. Think of it that way. It's almost like, you know, jihad is the addiction, and these people, the cluster, are the enablers. They're pushing it forward. And Kosovo has now become a place where a lot of individuals are radicalized and recruited, because these clerics, and also, by the way, charity organizations. And isn't it interesting that there is so often a connection between terrorism and jihad and charities in the Muslim world? It's really sick, isn't it? You know, when was the last time you heard of a non-Muslim charity with ties to terrorism? A charity, remember, it's trying to help people, right? Trying to help the sick, trying to help the wounded, trying to help, you know, orphans. But we're really also funneling money to suicide bombers. This is a particular thing in the Muslim world. This is not something that you see outside of the Muslim world. At least not that I'm aware of. And it's commonplace, right? You look at these groups, you know, Red Crescent Society and others, all these groups that are all over the world that are supposed to be doing charitable work. And by the way, their charity, of course, focuses on Islamic causes and helping fellow Muslims. It's, you know, it's I'm not familiar with a lot of sort of non-sectarian charitable work that the Muslim states are funding, meaning that it's for non-Muslims, right? That's not something that, you know, there are plenty of Christian missionary hospitals and such that will take anybody who comes in, right? You need help, we'll help you, because that's what we do, because that's what Jesus would want us to do. We don't care. We'll help you. In the Muslim context of charity, it's, well, you got to be a Muslim, really. And, oh, by the way, have you talked to this guy? Because he's got an idea for you. Maybe you should really live your faith and go fight with the Islamic State. That's how they do things. All funded by our so-called ally, Saudi Arabia, by our so-called friends in the Gulf. And not by all of them, meaning that not all of them are involved, but enough of them that this is a major problem. And I've seen this myself in much of the third world. This is all over the world. What's happened in Kosovo, and it's taken just, what, over a decade, and now here we are. They've done the same thing, built mosques and sent extremists to preach hate and Salafism and war with the West and jihad and hatred of Jews and Christians. They've done it in Africa. They've done it. They've done it in Europe. They've done it. Name a continent, name a place. I mean, maybe they've been kept out of North Korea. But other than that, I mean, they're all over. And it's all funded by people that are supposed, by countries that are supposed to be allied nations. And it happens very quickly. Got to go to a break here. I'll be back right after.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
All right, team, we have a super short segment here, so let me just tell you, we got Matt Walsh joining us at the top of the next hour. We're going to be talking about his latest piece in which he says, Christians, we are at war. I think you're going to hear it. So Matt Walsh will be joining. I know the team gets excited about that. Much more coming. Stay with me.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, Team Buck, welcome to Hour 2 of our Freestyle Friday. We are joined now by the one and only Matt Walsh. He is, of course, a Blaze contributor. You can read his latest on theblaze.com. He's also the author, creator of the Matt Walsh blog. Matt, thank you for calling in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we got a couple pieces wanted to ask you about. Let's start with check your privilege, liberal women. What's going on here? Azalea Banks and you have had a little back and forth.
Oh, that's an old school one. You're going way back in time.
Forget that one then. I'm sorry, Matt. That was that for some reason that got into my feed here. Christians, we're Matt's latest piece is Christians, we're at war. It's time to start acting like it. Let's talk about that one, which is from this week, not a year ago. Pardon me, Matt. Let's go. Christians, we're at war. Why?
I'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. Sure. Well, that was something I wrote earlier this week. You know, I think it's important for Christians, there's this kind of trend in Christianity lately that you know, we kind of want to look at religion and look at our faith as this very sort of nice and welcoming thing, which of course it is supposed to be welcoming, but at the same time we have to realize that there's actual warfare going on all around us that we can see physically, we can see the results of it, but it's also going on spiritually. This is what we believe as Christians. And so what I talk about in the piece is just, in my opinion, you know, you walk into a church, for instance, it should feel like you're walking into a fort, you know, a fortress on a battlefield, because that's essentially what you're doing. And I think we've kind of lost that. We've lost that warrior mentality. And we can see the fruits of that in the culture, that, you know, Christians are or true Christianity is obviously diminishing. And I think because we've lost the will and that fire and that passion to fight, because I think part of that is we don't think that we're allowed to think of things in those terms. We think that we're supposed to be the friendly and polite ones. But no, really, we're supposed to, you know, be warriors for truth.
And what would that entail? I mean, when you talk about being a warrior, you mean a willingness to speak up, to take the heat, to sort of just live your faith every minute of every day to the best of your ability, even if it means people say you're a bigot or you're a fanatic or you're, I mean, especially these days, I've been telling people for a while, and I'm guessing you have a similar sense of it, although I don't want to speak for you. And you could certainly tell us in a second if you agree. But the same way that they are still sort of hunting down the heretics from the gay marriage wars, if you will, of you know, but a few years ago or but a year ago when it was finally decided, and there's still people being punished for their opposition to that, and there are websites that publish who donated to Prop 8 and who opposed Prop 8 and such in California. They want to make the transgender agenda similar to that as well. Meaning that if you have any questions about this, if you want to talk about whether this is a form of mental illness and not actually something we should celebrate, you might lose your job. You might lose business. You might be sort of shouted down and actually ostracized from the public square. I think that's where that's going.
Yeah, and that's we have to be we don't want that to happen to ourselves, but we have to be willing to undergo those kinds of trials and tribulations and to make sacrifices. Of course, it's easy to say all this stuff. I'm not saying it because I think I'm perfect in that regard, that I'm some perfect soldier for Christ myself. But this is just, I'm just repeating what's basically in the Bible. And we also have to keep in mind that, you know, what's required of us can change depending on the circumstance. So obviously, if you want to be a Christian in the Middle East right now as we speak, that means that you might get marched out into a desert and beheaded. And that's what, if you're a Christian in the Middle East, in many parts of the Middle East, that's what you have to be open to that possibility if you want to actually stick with your beliefs. And by comparison, what we're going through here is minor. I mean, it's minor in comparison. Nobody's being killed for it here. The most that will happen is that you sacrifice a little bit of your reputation. Worst possible case is that you sacrifice money, which of course is no small thing, but it's not as bad as losing your life. And I think it's interesting that, you know, the parts of the world where being a Christian can get you literally killed, Middle East, some parts of Africa, you know, the parts of the world where it's a very physically dire situation for Christians, that's where often the faith happens to be the strongest. And here, it's not the same thing. It's just, it's a much more, you know, the assault on Christianity is much more understated. It's more passive in some ways. It's not a physical assault in a lot of ways, yet it's been much more effective in that, you know, even though our lives are not at stake, people are still abandoning their faith. So it
reminds me of my parents telling me stories from a priest who was visiting last summer. My parents are upstate, a couple of hours north of New York, and he's a Nigerian priest who was visiting the parish, this very small parish, telling stories about how every single day when as a Catholic priest, he gathers with his congregation in Nigeria, there's the very real threat of a suicide bomber coming into the church and trying to blow up everybody inside the church. It changes your sense of your faith very quickly when you're under that sort of threat, as you point out. In this country, it's different, obviously. You're talking more about the social pressures and the sort of the media narrative surrounding people who are trying to be actual Christians, I think, is a fair point to make. You know, if Salon, Matt, or The Nation, or one of those leftist sites were to, you know, engage in this discussion that we're having right now, or if they were to overhear it and, you know, decide that they would spend their time writing about it, I'm sure what they'd say is, oh, whiny Christians, you're, you know, 80% or whatever the demographics say now, you're 80% of America, it's so hard for you. And what I always think is interesting is that number is largely people who are sort of culturally or nominally Christian in some capacity. I think for a lot of people, Christianity has become more of just sort of a general identity than it is actually a faith and a means of living your life. And the best example I can point to are Catholics who are prominent Catholics in prominent politicians who are Catholics who are adamantly pro-choice, pro-abortion, and Catholics don't seem to care. And I'm just like, how are you a Catholic and not care? I'm a Catholic, so that's what I can speak to, but I just don't get it.
Yeah, and that's why you know, if we actually had the warrior mentality, and if our church leaders did, then, and I'm Catholic as well, so that's what it bothers me also. Is that, you know, the next time Nancy Pelosi attends, you know, the one of the three or four times she maybe attends a mass every year when there are cameras present, the presiding pastor or bishop should get up at the pulpit and announce to everyone in front of her that she is excommunicated and that she cannot receive communion and she's not a part of the church. And here's why, and lay it all out. Rebuke her publicly, humiliate her in public in front of everybody. That's what needs to happen, because this is war, and this is a woman that is, you know, among many, who is causing great scandal in the church, because she's a Catholic, she's a Christian, who is representing the faith as you know, as being something that is accepting of you know, child murder among many other evils. I mean, not only is she endorsing evil along with a lot of other Christians, but this is the worst danger, that these people drag others away from the faith because they misrepresent it and they cause scandal. So if we, you know, if we actually had a warrior mentality, and if our church leaders did, that's what they'd be doing. It's not nice. It's not fun. It's certainly not polite. But there are souls at stake. And I'll tell you something. If you go to Africa, churches in Africa, that's the kind of thing you probably see happen. You know, you're not going to be able to, as a politician in many places in Africa, stand up and say, "Hey, the church actually thinks that abortion is okay. They just don't want to tell you." If you say that, you're going to be publicly rebuked in front of everybody. And that's the way it needs to happen, because this is warfare. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, liberals will listen to a conversation like this and say, "Oh, you're whining, you know, people aren't being killed over here, maybe in the Middle East." That's one of the dangers of it, because, yeah, we're not being killed, but what we don't physically see are all of the souls that are being lost. You know, we don't see that part of it, but I don't know this to be the case, but I would venture a guess that many more Christians are losing their souls in America than there are Christians losing their souls probably in any other part of the world.
You know, one thing that I always feel like doesn't get as much attention as it should in these discussions, you know, there's a widespread awareness now. I don't think the way I would put it is, no serious person can ignore or pretend that it's not the fact that progressives have completely infiltrated and largely taken over college campuses and the universities, and the Department of Education and public schools are reflective of a progressive statist mentality, and that's largely across the country, although it varies depending on where you are in the country. But what you don't hear is the infiltration of sort of traditional Christian churches, the Catholic Church among them, and in some ways first and foremost, with social justice warrior mentality, with this sort of leftist, Marxist, Catholic worker stuff that you see popping up, which replaces doctrine, especially in the context of how Catholics should live their lives, with this sort of inclusiveness mentality of, well, I mean, we don't want anyone to feel excluded. It's like, well, no, if you're actually a believing Catholic, you know, some things are not okay. And that seems to have been lost. And I think part of it is because there has been an infiltration of the churches by individuals who hold this mentality and are spreading it from within.
Absolutely. And you'll notice that if you read the scripture, the word tolerance, for instance, I'm not going to say it's not in there at all in any context. It doesn't appear very often. And it's certainly never put forward as an absolute commandment or as a moral principle that we're supposed to just tolerate everything. Acceptance, I don't believe, appears in the Bible, and it certainly does not appear as a moral command that we're supposed to accept everything. But these are the new morals that, as you say, are obviously promoted by the schools and by liberals in the culture, but also by the churches. And what do you end up with? I mean, I was just reading with great horror, an article in some British newspaper about the new thing are men who dress up as dogs who live as, they did a documentary about it. And so now you have men dressing up in rubber dog suits and sleeping in dog crates and, you know, crawling around on all fours and chewing on chew toys. And this is just the next step. You know, they're trans canine, transgender, whatever. This is the next step. This is just the fruits that fall from the tree of tolerance because, you know, we say, well, they're not hurting anyone. They're having fun. So we're supposed to just accept it. We certainly can't denigrate it or laugh at it or dismiss it or anything like that. And this is what happens when you put tolerance up as this great commandment. So the only real solution to that is just to chop down the tree of tolerance entirely and realize that, you know, we're not called as Christians or as reasonable, common sense human beings to be tolerant and accepting of everything. You know, we're called to be discerning and even, yes, God forbid, judgmental in certain circumstances.
Yeah, the only thing that's unacceptable, it seems, is truth. Everything else is accepted. And once you abandon truth, that kind of makes sense. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Before we go into the break, Matt, I just want to ask you, based on your piece that you're talking about here today, it seems like you're saying Christians are at war, and it seems like it's a war that right now in this country, despite the demographic data and despite the fact that a lot of people would still say this is a Christian country, it feels like a war that I think a lot of believing Christians would say we are currently losing. The war is not lost, but it feels like we're losing. What do you think?
Yes, yeah, so I'm not going to give you the optimistic view. It's not my thing. So I'm going to say we're not only are we losing, but I think in a certain sense you could say it is lost in the sense that progressives set out to accomplish certain goals in the culture, and they have accomplished all of them pretty much at will. So what that means is, you know, there was a certain war being waged over a period of time to make some of these things into accepting, you know, mainstream things, abortion and so on, transgenderism, and they succeeded. You know, they succeeded, and so they won that. So I think what really the job of Christians now and of conservatives is not to say, well, we have to win the culture war. It's really to spark a new war, to start a counteroffensive. The progressives, you know, went on the offensive, and they won, and so now we're the losing side, and now we have to launch a counteroffensive. I think that's kind of the mentality we have to have.
A Christian counteroffensive. Everyone, you can read Matt's latest on theblaze.com. Christians, we're at war. It's time we start acting like it. Author of the Matt Walsh blog, and you should all follow him on Twitter if you're not already doing so. Matt, always appreciate your time. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Sponsor this half hour. Whoa, pardon me. Let's try that again. Sponsor this half hour. Silencer Shop. Look, silencers are legal in lots of states, and if you've ever had a chance to fire with a suppressor on your weapon, it's just a more pleasant, more fun shooting experience all around. They also look cool, and they can help your shooting accuracy. They are a good thing to have, and you got to go through some steps to get them. But it's going to get a little harder, and there's a lot of noise right now about changes that are coming to the silencer industry because of the 41F regulation that's going to be coming out. Starting on July 13th, 2016, 41F is going to mean that silencer transfer applications include FBI fingerprints, passport photos, and a whole lot more. But Silencer Shop has got your back with its Powered by Silencer Shop guarantee. Silencer Shop promises to process your transfer application successfully, or they will give you $100. That is the Powered by Silencer Shop guarantee. You just purchase an in-stock silencer and tax stamp between May 1st and July 6th using the Powered by Silencer Shop Buy It Local program. All transfer information must be submitted to Silencer Shop before July 8th. Get peace of mind to know your application is done before 41F and done correctly. There could be some other restrictions. Find out everything you need to know about the new 41F reg and the Powered by Silencer Shop guarantee at silencershop.com. Again, that is silencershop.com. Help make the world a quieter place, team. We'll be right back.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, the phone lines are open. It is Freestyle Friday. I'd like to hear from some of you on Team Buck. 888-900-3393. Greg in OKC. What is up, sir?
What is up, Buck? It's a great Friday for a great weekend.
Indeed.
Well, I just want to talk about, I know you, Michael, talked about the attack on Fallujah yesterday. And one of the aspects that
both Michaels, we had double Michael in the third hour yesterday. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're good. Was talking about the place that the White House has essentially left us in with their supporting of Iran and the nuclear deal. They really can't publicly at least, push back on Iran's support with the Shia militias that are now encircling Fallujah. Now, the army of Iraq has said that these militias are just on the border and they're just a defensive perimeter around the city. But we both know that they have the rocket technology, while crude, and the support from Iran. They're going to be shelling the city, which they have been already. And we know with the Shia militias that there's going to be looting, property destruction. I've even seen some videos and stuff coming out of some pretty horrific murders that they've committed over the last couple of days that have been coming out. And this is really a problem because from the Sunni
just to give you this, I'm sorry, Greg, go ahead.
No, I'm going to say from the Sunni side in the Middle East, they're seeing the support with close air support from the United States helping these militias. And this is only going to intensify the support that the Sunnis are going to start showing more outwardly to ISIS. Colonel Steve Warren just put out a tweet within the hour that said that, yes, U.S. Air power is supporting the attack in Fallujah. That doesn't say anything except, hey, we are accepting of these acts of violence. We're going to help the Shia militias. There's at least 12 documented militias that are in this fight. And this is a massive problem that I don't think anybody really wants to talk about. I mean, the AP reported yesterday that they're not Shia militias. They said paramilitary groups. I mean, this is the dishonesty and propaganda is wildly disproportionate to what's actually happening on the ground. It's just, yeah. It amazes me that this is allowed to even to just happen.
Those Shia militias are firing homemade rockets that they call Nimr rockets, specifically right. Named for Sheikh Nimr, who was executed earlier this year in Saudi Arabia. He is a Shia cleric who was executed for disobeying the Saudi state on January 2nd of this year. So the sectarian flavor is pretty obvious here. They're firing rockets named for an executed Shia cleric by the Saudis because they realize that the Saudis are the main backers of Sunni jihadist factions in the Middle East. So, oh yeah, Greg, the way this is being reported and the reality are two very separate things. Good to talk to you, my friend. As always, thank you for calling in. I'm glad we got a chance to chat. You enjoy your weekend, my friend. You enjoy your weekend and call us again soon. 888-900-3393 on those phone lines. I have a whole lot more to talk to you about, team. Stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, we're joined by a first-time guest in the Freedom Hut, Kayla Brandon. She is a reporter for Independent Journal. Kayla, thank you for calling in.
Hi, Buck. Thank you so much for having me.
So I know you've done a lot of reporting, a lot of research, a lot of information gathering on the Donald. What are some of the interesting things you've learned about Donald Trump, his supporters, and where all this stuff is going?
So our audience, in the most recent story, obviously Trump eating a Big Mac, basically celebrating the fact that he won the GOP nomination, him doing that basically resonated with all Americans. I couldn't find anything negative in our feed. So on Facebook, some of the top comments were, you know, do Hillary or Bernie make you excited to be an American as much as Donald Trump? Or, you know, tacos, McDonald's, he's just an average guy. Even with his buildings and billions of dollars, he's just one of us. So I think the thing that people need to realize is that Donald Trump might not be your typical, presidential candidate, but maybe that's what America wants.
And what was it you were saying about Tinder and Trump? That was interesting. Tell me more about that.
So this was a story that I went undercover for, which is sad to say that I had to go undercover on Tinder, but I guess in this day and age, doing that is something that people want to read about. And if, for those of you who are listening who aren't familiar with Tinder, it's kind of like a dating app, some people take it seriously. Others, it's just kind of something to do, I guess, to maybe meet new people. But basically, I created a profile, and my bio said, passionate politiquette, Trump supporter since 1991. If you don't vote for Trump, just swipe left, which means you don't like me. Hashtag make America great again. And I went into it thinking there is no way that any guy is going to click on this profile and say, yeah, I definitely want to date this crazy person because she's so passionate. And this was done, I have to say, this was done 2 months ago before Trump clinched the nomination. And an overwhelming amount of guys, said that they were Trump supporters. Now, whether that was true or not, I was giving them completely bizarre responses. I mean, someone said, one man approached me and said, hey, you're cute. P.S. Trump's got my vote. And I said, hey, are you really a Trump supporter? Are you just saying that? And he said, I am a Republican. My number one vote is Trump, but I'll support whoever gets the nomination because I can't deal with any more liberal BS. And I literally responded with this book. I said, liberals are terrible, terrible people, especially Clinton. Benghazi, I mean, come on, total loser. This guy actually responded and said, yeah, they really are. I just can't believe they believe that stuff. They have zero common sense. Clinton always has an excuse. These people,
I kind of like this guy. Wait, is this bad? This guy sounds like he'd be my friend.
But I think what I'm trying to show is the rhetoric is the stuff that I said to these guys were things that literally Trump had either said or things that he would probably say based on what he said in the past. And what made me so shocked is they actually were like, yeah, I'm down with this. I like a girl that likes Trump, you know?
Why? I'm kind of confused as to why that's shocking to you. And also, by the way, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that guys may, if they like you, they may change sort of their political stance, especially in the early days, to make it more likely they'll get a date.
Right. And I totally agree with you. I based this whole thing on a study that I found, and it was saying that, you know, having a similar age with someone is one thing in terms of looking for a mate, but actually a study found that political ideologies were a factor as well. So I thought, okay, maybe if I pose as kind of someone that's totally 100% for Trump, will not talk to anyone who is not for Trump, I thought, oh, you know, I probably won't get a lot of people. And I had a lot of guys responding saying they totally agreed with what he was saying and they wanted a girl that was like that. So it just makes you think, you know, I don't know, I guess at the time I thought there's no way anyone will click on this, but a lot of people did. So it's pretty telling. I think, like, to your point, guys are just going to click on anything at this point. You know, they're looking for a date. They'll pretty much say anything is what I found.
Yeah, this is quite an experiment you've run. What do you think about the possibility of a Sanders-Trump debate, by the way? It's the main Drudge headline today.
Yeah, you know, I think that's going to be really interesting. I think they have such strong support on both sides, and their supporters completely dislike each other. I mean, they couldn't be more opposite. So I think what'll be interesting is seeing how their supporters react to it and how, you know, I mean, you've seen so much violence and vicious protests, to be honest, on both sides of the aisle. I'm really interested to see what protests and riots ignite over this debate.
Oh, if you got like the most ardent Trump supporters squaring off on the street against the most fired up Bernie Sanders revolutionaries, it would certainly make for a combustible mix.
Yeah, actually, one of our video guys, his name's Kenny, he did an experiment that he posed as a Trump supporter and then posed as a Bernie supporter and asked for hugs outside of their they were having events. And it's really interesting. I'll post some of the videos on Twitter so you guys can see. But it's really interesting to see what happens and see that at the end of the day, politics really is pushed aside. And if someone's asking for a free hug, a lot of times they get a good response from both Trump and Sanders supporters.
All right. So, Kayla, if people want to see your latest reporting for Independent Journal, where would they go?
So they're going to go to www.injo.com. You can also just type in your browser Independent Journal Review, and it'll send you that way as well.
All right. Kayla Brandon, thank you very much for joining. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Interesting. Ty, are we clear in terms of, is the guest no longer with us? Okay. So let's take a call from Brian in Chicago. Brian, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Hey, Buck. Big fan. And
thank you.
I'm only a podcast listener, but I happen to be off today, so I get to call you.
I appreciate it.
What concerns me, and I'm curious about, and I know you've been to that region, you know, when we look at the Muslim world from Morocco all the way through Pakistan, you know, if you go to Google Earth and look at satellite photo, you see these old ancient cities surrounded by vast deserts. And I happened to catch some State Department official on C-SPAN a long time ago, and he made the point that the population in that region has grown fivefold since 1950. And I'm wondering if you agree with that fact. And what concerns me is when I listen to conservative talk and in other American media, the focus is always on what we're going to do to the Middle East or how we're going to interact with these people, and not on what that area really is. I mean, I see it as an old, overpopulated world where most adults really have no economic future. And tell me how I'm wrong, basically.
Well, it's actually not. I mean, when you say it's old, I don't know if you mean it's like ancient civilization. If you're talking about demographically, the problem the Middle East has is not old people. That's the problem that Japan and Europe have. The problem the Middle East has is a huge youth bulge, a huge spike in the number of young people. Life expectancy has gone up dramatically. GDP of some of the states, obviously in the 20th century, because of oil revenues, have gone up dramatically in some of these states. And you have 30% roughly of what we call the Mideast, broadly speaking, is between the ages of 15 and 29. So there's a huge – I'm sorry?
Well, I misspoke. I should have said like an old world type economy where it was focused on, you know, agricultural
production. Oh, yeah. Well, that's – no, absolutely. Well, there's not really much economy at all. I mean, and I should – I don't have all these facts and figures at my fingertips, you know, off the top of my head. But generally speaking, if you were to take the entirety of the Mideast's hydrocarbon revenue off the table – the GDP of all the Arab countries put together would be less than that of, I think, Spain. And also, right. If you add all of the books translated, from around the world into Arabic every year, from all the Muslim countries, and then you looked at, I think it's either Spain or Norway. I forget what the comparison was directly. It does less than that one country. So you don't have a tremendous amount of, you know, yes, the internet has broken down a lot of barriers and has been, but there's still a lot of cultural ossification that's in place. And economically speaking, you take oil out of the Mideast and there's really not a whole lot. There have been some efforts using oil money to build them to create sort of tech hubs. And, you know, Dubai is now this like shimmering brand new city that's sprouted up out of the debt. Well, that's only possible because they've got unbelievable amounts of oil wealth, right? I mean, if it wasn't for that, you'd have nothing there.
As we move
globally away from an economy, because, you know, hydrocarbon energy is still an absolute necessity for the global economy, right? I mean, you can't have a modern economy without oil, natural gas, coal, et cetera, despite all the whining and gnashing of teeth from the climate alarmists and the green energy lobby. So as that continues to happen, there's going to be a tremendous amount, I think, of upheaval in the Middle East because they don't really have much in the way of developed economies. I mean, places like Egypt, you know, you got to kind of be like a state bureaucrat or you work for the tourism industry or, you know, there's not like a manufacturing base that's really worth all that much. There's not an information economy that can compete with others around the rest of the world. And so there are going to be a lot of problems. Yeah, I mean, demographically, they have an issue. They have a lot of young people with very dim economic prospects, and they have economies that are increasingly going to be under pressure. I mean, you see what happened in Venezuela. Venezuela's problem is that when the oil was $120 a barrel, they're like, this is great. It's party time. Let's fill our pockets, and let's allow a lot of graft and fraud and waste and abuse and just outright theft. And now that oil is, you know, below 50% of that, a barrel, they are completely out of luck, and their economy's in absolute free fall. And, you know, a Happy Meal costs $170 at the actual rate of exchange, and inflation's through the roof. And it's because they didn't make the necessary adjustments to the, or they didn't rather prepare, I should say, for the future by actually building something beyond a one-trick pony economy, which is what they have. And, you know, the Saudis aren't really that far behind, but they, you know, they're sort of still able to get on by with their vast oil reserves. But as we move away from that, what's up?
The oil will run out someday. I mean, I think
we'll move away from oil as an energy source before oil runs out. That's my personal opinion. But we will move away from it. That's already naturally happening. I mean, that's why all the sort of green, green energy and climate change alarmists. I'm like, yeah, this is all naturally occurring. I mean, if you look at the history of what's used for fuel to fuel economies going back to the Industrial Revolution, right? I mean, originally, why did we start using kerosene? You know, what was the purpose? Why did we start using fossil fuel instead? Well, because we were using whale fat, and going out and hunting whales is an arduous and inefficient and very mean procedure. We found something better.
Battleships, wasn't it? Oil was
What's
very
up?
Useful for battleship technology. When the Royal Navy was king of the world, the steam turbine, you know, oil-fired steam turbines was the way to run a battleship.
But before that, it was coal. And before that, that's where steamships. And, you know, whether it was a steamship on the Mississippi or anywhere else, I mean, you're just shoveling coal into the furnace to create the, the engine propulsion necessary to get the ship moving. So, yeah, I mean, these are the sorts of things that, but that's already been happening, right? So we've gone from whale blubber, melted whale blubber, I should say, whale fat, to, you know, we had kerosene and then oil or coal and oil. And now we're moving to natural gas. And, you know, you can see the car. These are more efficient and therefore less carbon comes out of the burning of these different fossil fuel sources. Any of you who kind of want a really good quick history, not quick, but a good sort of overview of all of this should read a book that I've mentioned before on the air. Daniel Yergin's The Prize. And it kind of takes you through the history of oil. It helps you understand the Middle East better, but it also helps you understand. It's a fantastic book. I mean, you'll be like, wow, that's right. People forget Pennsylvania was like the Saudi Arabia of its day. You know, Pennsylvania was like the first place. And then all of a sudden, Texas became like, oh, gosh, we were the biggest oil exporter in the world for quite a while. And now we're getting back to it because of our technological improvements with shale and fracking. Did we lose? I think I just Bucksplained too much. And he was like, OK, I'm done. Please keep listening to the show. I want to let you speak again. I just got all excited because we're talking about something that I find interesting. Uh-oh, almost out of time. Got to go to break. We'll be back.
Buck Sexton. The Blaze Radio Network.
Listening to the Buck Sexton Show
only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Just one thing about our friend who called in from Independent Journal was posing as a Trump supporter on Tinder. As a guy, I have to tell you, I think the only time as a conservative and a male who is neither engaged nor married, the only time you can hedge a little bit on your politics and it's okay, you get a little bit of leeway, okay? Is, you know, when you're trying to get that first date, right? You don't be too crazy. You know how many times people have been to me like, you're Buck Sexton. Wait a second. And then they'll Google me or something. Usually it's if I meet them and then I ask them out. They're like, you fill in on radio for Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh? And I'd be like, I do. And that's fantastic. But let's also talk about how I grew up in New York and I'm a very reasonable fellow. You know, got to calm him down a little bit. Maybe this is why I'm not married. So anyway, it's just kind of funny. It's like, yeah, of course guys will, if the guys on the dating app like the lady they see in the photos, they're not going to have a problem with the politics, at least not for a while. So I thought that's kind of funny. It's like, yeah, of course they'll say they love Trump supporters. I want to go on a date. Maybe I'm missing something, but the important point here is, guys, you get a get out of jail free card on this.
Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
spreading freedom across the nation. This is
3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 3 in the Freedom Hut today. As always, it is a pleasure, it is an honor to have you with me. I would be remiss if I didn't spend some time today on President Obama's speech in Hiroshima. I've read the transcript of it, and I've read some of the commentary around it. And look, I try to be fair-minded in my criticism of President Obama. So I don't want to fall into the reflexive, reactionary posture of everything Obama does is bad because he's like a stealth commie and you can't trust him. And I disagree with his policies. I think he's been dishonest on some very big issues as president. I'm going to say disagree with his policies. I've been trying to be as much in the Obama resistance vanguard as is humanly possible for the 5 years that I've been in media. Okay, so I don't think anybody has any questions about that. But I also don't just want to say, well, Obama does it. Obama sucks, so that must be bad. You try to keep it real here, right? When the Bin Laden raid happened afterwards, I wasn't like, well, good work with that one, Obama. It's like, okay, yeah, the Bin Laden raid was well executed, and the administration got a lot of credit for it. I mean, they certainly deserve some credit for it. Okay. I mean, the real credit goes to the SEALs and the Special Operations and CIA that did it, but that's another day. So it's with that proviso or that preface that I get into Obama showing up in Japan for this ceremony, which it seems to me is one of the things that I find most troubling for prominent people, politicians, celebrities, anybody with a big platform, which is wrapping oneself in tragedy, in wide scale death and horrific atrocities, and sort of using that emotional context for the elevation of the self. Right. So somebody gets up to give a speech about how terrible. Let me just give you an example and then I'll start to talk about how this translates in my mind into this Obama speech at Hiroshima. Somebody gets up and talks about how horrific the Sandy Hook shootings were, the murders of preschool children by a deranged, maniacal killer. And very quickly, you'll notice sometimes the conversation will turn from that horrific event and that's why I'm standing up against guns and trying to save more children in the future. And you realize, well, what is this really about? Is this about Sandy Hook, or is this about the person who's giving the speech about Sandy Hook? Is this about saving children from violence from guns, or is this about somebody who is using that emotional appeal as a means of elevating their own stature, their own moral worthiness? Essentially to engage in a very unseemly moral preening. Sort of stand behind the gravestones of young children in order to elevate oneself politically or in the media or anywhere else. And President Obama showing up 71 years after we dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and then, of course, in Nagasaki. Why? You ask the question, what is this really about? If this is about mourning the dead, well, it's been 70 years, and I'm sure they've been mourned by their families in the interim period. And what exactly has... why? You get into this, why now? And as I read the speech, what it seems very clear to me, at least, and you can take this as or leave it as you like, is that really this is just Obama wanting to make sure that he's on the record before he leaves the Oval Office saying that he wants a nuclear weapon-free world, which is a fun thing for someone to say, a nice thing for someone to say, a very self-aggrandizing thing for someone to say, and it's just worthless, really. Thanks, Obama. This is sort of the equivalent of some rock star somewhere who just stands up and says, you know, oh, I just want a world where there's just peace and love. Well, that's nice for the people who have gathered at that concert venue to hear, but it has no meaning. And President Obama, and now I know that we're talking about the gravity and seriousness of a massive loss of life in the Second World War, and I'm not, I'm illustrating different things by pulling up these analogies, and I'm aware that we're talking about 100,000 people who were incinerated, and it's horrific, and it's men, women, and children, but I'm also aware of the complete annihilation of Dresden, for example, with incendiary bombs. A purposeful policy, by the way, of the Royal Air Force to just destroy entire German cities as a means of ending the war. There are men, women, and children in those cities, too. I'm perfectly aware of the Japanese atrocities, including the rape of Nanking, which is something that you don't really learn very much about in school. When you read about it, it's hard to believe that it could have actually happened in the 20th century, despite everything else that we know about the 20th century. The wide-scale, wanton slaughter that occurred in mainland China at the hands of the Japanese, as well as the Japanese treatment of other regional Asian populations, including the people in the Philippines and elsewhere. I mean, the brutality of Imperial Japan and the inhumanity and the deeply racist nature of the Imperial Japanese, something that I don't think we really get. You know, we're all very aware of how horrific Nazi Germany was. Right? It's difficult to find an American who doesn't know right off. You know, and when we think of, when someone is asked, well, the greatest evil of all time, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Nazi Germany. When you want to say something is as evil can be, Nazi Germany. I mean, oftentimes, you know, in the number two slot, if you know history, you might sort of think, well, you know, I think Stalin would probably be pretty close to, you know, 20 million dead. But anyway, but number one, Nazi Germany, Hitler, right? The large scale extermination of millions of human beings, men, women, children, the elderly, the infirm, because of this deeply evil, racist, Nazi National Socialist ideology. But we're all very aware of that. We know that. That's a history that's known. And in Europe is still trying to sort of come to grips with what happened there. The Japanese racism and evil in the Second World War is not really as widely known in this part of the world. It's remembered by the Asian countries around Japan that suffered at the hands of the Imperial Japanese. But keep in mind, not only did they engage, they also allied themselves with Nazi Germany. They were aware of what's going on. They were enablers of Hitler's Nazism. Right? And yet, on the one hand, if you ask people, you say, well, how many people died in Hitler's death camps? And the number, they'll always say 6 million Jews, which is true. It was 6 million Jews. It was also 5 million non-Jews. The total number is 11 million killed in the death camps, which includes about 3 million Catholic Poles and includes nearly a million Gypsies. Those numbers are not as well known, by the way. And I don't think that we uphold our moral obligation to history by forgetting about 5 million people who were also put in gas chambers and ovens. I think that we should know the full number. It was 6 million Jews and 5 million non-Jews. It was 11 million total murdered in Hitler's death camps. How many people even know about the rape of Nanking? How many people even know about what the Japanese did? I'm just pointing this out because we're talking about a war that had all in, I think the estimates are 40 to 60 million people killed. And it was 71 years ago that we dropped an atomic bomb. It killed 100,000 people. And President Obama is going there to give a speech. What is the purpose of the speech? Does Obama really think that it's going to help Japan heal? I mean, Japan has been a strong U.S. ally in the post-World War II period. Does he really... What's the purpose of this? And I don't like to put this out there because it's a pretty nasty indictment of somebody's near malignant narcissism. I mean, kind of a shocking level of narcissism. Is this really about Obama just going on record that he doesn't like nuclear weapons before he leaves office? What does he think he's accomplishing by doing this? You know, you get down to this, the bottom of the speech. Originally, it says, the world was forever changed here, but today the children of the city will go through their day in peace. What a precious thing that is. It is worth protecting and then extending to every child. That is a future we can choose, a future in which Hiroshima and Nagasaki are known not as the dawn of atomic warfare, but as the start of our own moral awakening. What does that mean? As I'm sure many of you are familiar, and I know many of you have a knowledge of the Second World War that unquestionably exceeds my own. The calculation made here was, well, how many will die with an invasion of mainland Japan? How many Americans will die? How many Japanese will die? And, oh, by the way, the Japanese and the Nazis were trying to rush as fast as possible to get nukes, and they probably would have just burned our cities down even after we had surrendered. I mean, you know. They weren't going to. Who knows if they would have stopped? Japan allied themselves with that evil. We gave them the choice to surrender. They would not surrender. Japan was working alongside the Nazis. And they said that they weren't going to surrender. We said we have this weapon. We said we don't want to use it. And they refused to surrender because they were, just like Hitler thought of the Aryan Germans, the Japanese thought of themselves as a sort of master race. And their emperor was a god. And they can't lose because they're the Japanese. And the Japanese were better than everybody else. Ethnically, genetically superior. That was what was taught in Imperial Japan. That was what was believed. You want to talk about xenophobia. And we dropped these bombs and the war ended. In retrospect, I think it's a very hard case to make that there was an alternative or that the alternative decision would have been better. What commander-in-chief, what responsible and moral commander-in-chief of the United States and our allies would have said, yes, let's lose a half a million or a million young Americans because the Japanese just refused to bend? So when President Obama says that this is not the dawn of the age of, isn't it interesting? We dropped two nuclear bombs to end the largest war, the greatest loss of life in any war in history. There have been no nukes dropped since. It seems sort of strange to use this as the jumping off point for a discussion about how, well, we shouldn't be using nuclear weapons on each other. We're all quite aware of that. We really don't need President Obama to say that. And it just seems to me to be an exercise, again, in Obama legacy chasing. And instead of, as some do, standing behind the tombstones of the children of Sandy Hook to make some point about gun control, you have President Obama giving a speech that seems to be elevating himself and his sense of the world and using the horrific death of 100,000 people to draw attention to it. When there's nothing that's going to come out of this speech, there's no policy, there's no rationale behind it other than Obama thinks he's healing the world. Well, if he believes that, and maybe he does, then he's acting in good faith, but then he's also delusional, isn't he? So which one is preferable? That this is just Obama chasing a legacy and he figures, why not? I'll stop over there. Or that Obama is still so in love with himself and his role in the world as somebody who can stop the rise of the seas and heal the planet. And that is a quote, as you know, that he has to stop in Japan and add his commentary to how we brought the biggest, bloodiest, most horrific war in the planet's history to an end. Even for this president, I found this to be surprising. And I know about everyone say, Buck, the bowing tour and going and bowing to these world leaders and always apologizing for America. And was this sort of a quasi-apology? I don't even take that approach. I just, what is the purpose here? The fact that it's murky to me, or the fact that it's sort of left open-ended is a better way of saying it, to me is indicative of the fact that this was really about Obama. And we're talking about a nuclear weapon being dropped and killing 100,000 people. And yet somehow I read this transcript and to me, it's still just about Obama. And that's pretty deeply, horrifically unsettling. That one person could be that out of touch. That's just how I read it. Maybe Maybe I'm wrong. Be back after the break.
This is the Buck Sexton Show
on the Blaze Radio Network. Show.
That's pretty funny. One of you asked me on Twitter in the break, have I ever posed as a Democrat to get a date? Have I ever gone undercover as a Hillary supporter? Oh, I will have you know the answer is no. Although I will admit to occasionally playing up my libertarian tendencies. As I've said before, a libertarian is what a conservative calls himself at a New York City cocktail party so that people don't boo or hiss at him, right? That's my dun-dun-dun. It's my libertarian joke. But it is something that works a lot. But I'm a very libertarian, very socially liberal. What does that mean? And am I even really that socially liberal? Question mark. Depends on what we're talking about. But that's a good way to do it. So yeah, I've sort of played up the libertarian side of things. You know, so if they're like, excuse me, but like, are you like super like right wing? Like, are you like one of those crazy right wing people? I'm like, I mean, it depends on obviously how intrigued by this person asking the question I am. But the way to get around it is, of course, always to be like, well, I'm a libertarian. I'm a socially liberal and fiscally and from a defense perspective, I'm very conservative. So I like money and killing bad guys, but I like to let people do what they want. You know, kind of got to go into like Dos Equis mode there a little bit, like the Dos Equis man. Chad in San Diego, save me from my dating discussion. What is up?
Yeah, I'm a lover, not a fighter, but I'm also a fighter, so watch out.
there we go.
Yeah, that was your lead on. No, but I would say some of the things that are coming up is people are having the never Trump, never Clinton attitude, and they're saying, well, we can always go with the third party. The libertarians are waiting for us to come and vote for them. The only thing about this is that if you don't actually believe in the libertarian candidate, the interpretation is just that the libertarians are going to be stealing the votes from whichever candidate that you're initially going for, or if it's the never Clinton side, it can be the Green Party. So what my proposal was is instead of doing that, just write down your own name on there, or at least, so like, I don't know, you can even throw my name on there. You do like a hashtag on there just to show that you're opposing the candidates in general, and you're not really going off to a third direction. Just because you're not as, you know, you're not fully into whoever it is that is. So, because a lot of the problems that come down is that a lot of the interpretations after is that with Gore is Ralph Nader was sucked out all these.
Well, no, and look, if Ross Perot, I mean, to borrow from Yogi Berra, I mean, I'm afraid with this election we're going to have deja vu all over again. Because without Ross Perot, you don't have Clinton winning. You know, the first Clinton, Bill, hey, what's up? I would have lost. He would have lost. Yeah. Thanks, Ross Perot. So these people who are, you know, I know we had Jason on yesterday, and he was very fervent in the third party can win. He can call back, and we can continue to discuss that. We went into a hard break. That's absolutely not going to happen. I mean, we can place bets, and then we can come on air afterwards and see who's right. Not going to happen. So and then you can say, what's the point of voting if you live in a blue state? Well, you know, then you get into, is it your civic responsibility? But yeah, no, I mean, if you live in a totally blue state, you know, is anyone really going to look at you strangely if you don't vote? I mean, maybe. Although Trump thinks he can win these things.
The problem with that, though, is that afterwards they interpret it as like, oh, it's just people are apathetic towards the process. They don't actually say people showing up and not voting for the president. They don't say it's an indictment against the actual people that are running. They always say it's just the people are lazy. They didn't care about enough to come and vote. And so if you actually show up, you vote for the people at like the House and Senate level, and all the different local ones, and then you basically throw out a hashtag stating, you know, never Trump or never Clinton or anything like that, then it'll actually give out a bigger message than otherwise putting out there. I mean, going back to Perot, the big Perot message that I took out of that is, if they're arguing, between...
Chad, we're out of time, my friend, but thank you for calling in. It's break time. Be back in just a few.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Our team, we're joined now by our friend Inez Felcher. She is a contributor at The Resurgent. Inez, good to talk to you.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think about Marco Rubio's current situation? He has said that he would be honored to speak on behalf of Trump at the Republican convention. He wants to help him get elected. People are giving Marco a lot of heat for this. Is he just the first of many to fall in line? Should we just get used to this? Do you think some GOP politicians are going to stand strong? You know, never Trump politicians are going to stand strong.
Well, there have been a few who have stood strong. Although I am disappointed to see that Marco Rubio has reversed himself in this way. Although I did think that he made a good point when he kind of fired back about it on Twitter. He said, you know, hey, I got in the race. I ran. I jumped into the arena. I tried to prevent this from happening. You don't have a leg to stand on if you're criticizing me, if you weren't essentially in the arena trying to stop this. And I do think he has a really good point on that score, because I think that a lot of people are starting to get frustrated that there's a lot of these folks out there, you know, Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse, who have made a really good case for a third party, but seem to be really reluctant to actually step into the arena and compete. So
we can talk third party in a second, but just in terms of the Monday morning quarterbacking that we all kind of like to do in politics, even though we probably shouldn't, cause it's not fair, but it's fun. There's a lot of blame to go around if someone is of the mind that Trump needed to be stopped. And some in my audience believe that Trump is fine and some think he's great. And some are kind of slowly warming up to him, I think. But if you think that Trump should have been stopped, you can't tell me that Trump should have been stopped and then leave out the fact that I think Marco made some very big errors in his anti-Trump campaign. I think Cruz made some errors. Cruz was way too friendly and way too nice to the Donald early on when, you know, the Donald was crushing one opponent after another. If you wanted to stop his momentum, I think you can make the argument it should have been done then. So, you know, I think Marco does have a point in saying whether people think that he should be backing Trump or not. Hey, like, you know, you got to give some credit to the people that tried. Don't say that you're a never Trumper and then turn and look at all the people that actually tried to stop Trump from winning the primary and forget that they were trying to stop him from winning the primary.
Right. And I think Barbara has a good point with that. Although I do think that sort of Cruz's criticism of Trump ramping up as time went on, I think a lot of at least conservatives, grassroots conservatives, Tea Partiers, initially, so I, you know, was a member of three Tea Parties in three different states. I've been a member of the Tea Party, you know, there's no clarion card or anything, but since 2009. And I remember thinking that my sort of friends in the Tea Party were about evenly split in the beginning, with half of them just liking Trump for the fact that he was giving, you know, Reince Priebus hives. And that was enough initially. But and then as some more of his views came out and how deeply sort of not conservative his views were, those people started to shift. I don't know if that's where Cruz was at. I'm not sure if it was a cynical move or if he just thought that, oh, hey, this guy is bringing up some points that have been ignoring, like the immigration point, like many of the, you know, a lot of people have sort of dissected why his message has resonated the way that it has. But I do think that a lot of people sort of initially thought he might be better than a more conservative voice than he actually has turned out to be. And so I think there are a lot of people.
That is a certainly an interpretation of what happened that I think is a fair one. I would just say that I had conversations back in the day, in the earlier days of the primary, back in like September, October timeframe, maybe, no, October really, with people who were adamantly never, who were already writing articles about how Trump has never been a conservative, he never will be a conservative, and it was clear to us discussing this offline, and these are people that had already put it in writing, that the Cruz strategy was to essentially stay in the sort of the safe slot and like the two spot, you know, and be nice to Trump and then eventually turn around and try to pull off a win. Now, maybe that was the best option, you know, for those who want to. Maybe that was the best. We'll never know. But I do think it's interesting to look back at it in retrospect and say, well, you know, it didn't work. So maybe it wasn't the best possible option. But as to what can work in the future, because we can't prove. Well, you know, the past is the past to some degree, and I can't prove one way or the other whether this theory is right or wrong. Third party, people have been calling in. They've been wanting to talk about this. I try not to be dismissive of it, but I try to be realistic about it. And I have to say that I have a hard time being realistic and not therefore dismissive. What say you, Ms. Felcher?
Well, I actually am not dismissive of a third party for several reasons. One, if you look at the recent set of polling that's coming out, it looks like 6 in 10 Americans either deeply dislike or hate both presidential candidates. I don't think you've seen those kind of numbers in previous races. I don't think, I don't know that there's ever been two so strongly negatively perceived candidates for the two major parties. Second of all, if there was a third party run, I think it would be somebody who's higher profile than previous third-party candidates. A large part of the problem with third-party candidates getting no traction is that nobody really knows who they are because the media, you know, they're not in the debates because they never cross the threshold of polling in order to get into them. I think a conservative third-party candidate would have a fairly easy time crossing that polling threshold to get into the debates. And then I think it's a very different ballgame than it has been in the past. And three, a lot of people talk about missing deadlines in the state. There's some very good cases on the books about the unconstitutionality of keeping people out on that basis. There was a case in 1983 where the Supreme Court struck down those kinds of limitations on a third party in Ohio. So I actually think that, to kind of tie back to my earlier point, I actually think the ground is very fertile, probably more fertile than it ever has been in our lifetimes for this kind of run.
We're actually at time. We're running into a hard break. I will have you back because I want to continue this conversation with you about the third party situation. Inez Felcher is a contributor for The Resurgent, and you can follow her on Twitter, and you should. Inez, thank you for calling, and we will continue this.
Thank you.
All right, team. We're at break, right? I got to go, Ty. All right. We'll be right back.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.
Listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
You know, it's interesting, team. Earlier, I mentioned on the program that one thing that Islamists love to do is seize control of education, right? This is straight out of the playbook. They've done it in country after country. And what they do is, of course, they then exclude all sort of forms of education that are haram. So the humanities, you know, they're not reading Shakespeare, please. It's just Quran and then a lot of science. And this is one of the reasons why there's sort of a you can sort of see represented among the upper echelons of the jihadists stretching back to the Soviet-Afghan war even. And then afterwards, you'll see a lot of people that are sort of referred to as, you know, the engineer or the doctor. There has been a preference, a longstanding preference among hardline Islamists for the sciences in one form or another. Because they can justify that under Islamic doctrine as well. It's necessary for progress, for the Islamic world's progress technologically, right? That's okay. But when you start getting into literature and outside ideas and paintings and the Renaissance in Italy and no, that's all not stuff that should be known, not stuff that should be taught. And so this is why, of course, you have a lot of terrorists running around who are, you know, the doctor, the engineer. Zawahiri, for example, was a doctor, an MD. And there are many others who have engineering backgrounds. You'll find that very commonly among a fair amount of terrorists. No offense, engineers. I'm just saying that in the Muslim world, there has been for a long time this preference for, if you're going to get a degree in sort of a higher level degree, sort of the undergraduate or post, particularly the postgrad level, it has to be in the sciences or math, engineering, something like that. Because if it's in the humanities, then you have these Western and outside influences that can creep in. And the only thing that can fill that void is the Quran and Islam and the history of Islamic conquest and what's going on with the Muslims. And really just the Quran. the Quran. And that's something that has been recognized for a long time. I think actually one of the deals, even in a otherwise pretty sleepy place like Jordan, also known as the Hashemite Kingdom of Boredom, no offense, Jordan. They let the Islamists there, the Muslim Brotherhood there, have a say in education as a means of keeping them quiet. Well, that's a good short-term thing to do, maybe. But in the longer term, you start churning out more and more people who are not okay with a sort of 21st century approach to education and to or even 21st century. Try like a 19th century or 18th century approach to education. That's what starts to happen. And of course, this is one of these times where I'm speaking about this in this context of foreign countries and what goes on elsewhere. Meanwhile, here on campus, you got a bunch of lunatics running around. They can't handle it. This is in this country, you know, the land of the home and the, you know, the home of the brave and land of the free. Did I say the land of the home? Whatever. You know what I mean? The home of the brave and the land of the free. Sorry. It's been a long day in the hut already. And we have people that can't listen to opposing ideas. We have people that don't want to hear about how there's anything out there other than Islam. There's anything out there other than fill in the blank. I'm sorry, not Islam. Then progressive values. I got the Middle East confused with what's going on here for a second. They just want to hear more and more of the progressive echo chamber in this country. They don't want to hear anything else. They have absolutely no interest whatsoever in opposing ideas. And what I always find so interesting is that they never think about what will happen when they're exposed to these opposing ideas in the real world. They're just hoping to sort of stay in the liberal bubble forever, right? That they'll be able to move to a city where they're surrounded by people who agree, and that they have the media reinforcing that they're right all the time and just mocking the ideas of other people, right? Just mocking it constantly. And I always have to laugh. These are like the liberals you see in these college campuses. They'll become young adults and they'll start to pay taxes and they'll start to see how successful or not successful municipal services are dealing with a variety of things. And they'll see how government in action is really the status quo. The status quo is doing nothing. The status quo is bureaucracy, inefficiency. And yet they still think that government is the solution to all problems, right? That evidence doesn't change their beliefs. They're so hardened in these belief systems. And that's true of undergrads. It's also true, and this is particularly concerning, and this makes me think of this Rasmussen poll that's out right now, of people who go to law school, lawyers. And when you think about the fact that judges tend to overwhelmingly come from the ranks of lawyers, obviously, and prosecutors, federal prosecutors, state and local prosecutors, lawyers, people that know the law, people that have, in many ways, with the only exception possibly, or the only sort of comparable being the IRS and the taxation authorities, the greatest leverage over the destruction of individuals, ideologies, opposing ideas, using the law as a weapon, 82% of law professors, according to Rasmussen, are Democrats. 82% across the country. So you just have Democrat, absolutely polluting the minds of people in law school with the notions of the living constitution and the sanctity of Roe v. Wade. I mean, I knew a far left professor at Amherst who was sort of like a rock star professor, though I always thought he was kind of a jerk and was overrated. He's very progressive and leftist, but he'd be like, Roe v. Wade is a great thing for America. Terrible law, though. Terrible law. I mean, it's just nonsense. They're just making it up as they go along with that one. But I know there are other professors out there who say, oh, no, it was rightly decided and it's now sanctified and cannot be changed. You're like, look, I mean, no, I'm not even getting into the morality and the disguise. I'm just saying it's just obviously bad law. We believe that there's a right to privacy that's inherent because we believe it's there. And then we're going to take this other thing that has nothing to do with private. I mean, it's just crazy. But this is what all these kids are being taught. You know, my own sister is in law school right now. And, you know, I'm constantly telling her to keep her head down and don't, because I say this to all of you, undergrad, grad school, don't sacrifice yourself on the altar now. Get where you need to go. Use that credential. Get to that next step. And then you can stand up and be brave. Don't let them fail you. Don't let them ruin your academic career. Don't let them keep you out of a top grad school. If you got to go deep cover as a conservative on campuses, I'm not saying hide all your beliefs from all your friends, but in class, don't be a martyr on a college campus for conservative. It's not worth it to sacrifice your grades. Speak out, write for the papers, go and do, and we don't really protest because we're conservatives. We have better things to do, but, you know, organize, try to change it, but don't let the teachers fail you, because they'll do it. They'll do it. The worst grade I got the last 2 years I was at Amherst. The worst grade. The only grade I got that was below an A-. For for my last 2 years there was a class on the American right. It was a sociology class. Why do you think I got my worst grade in 2 years? Because I was like, you're just mocking conservatives in this class all the time. And I wrote that in my papers. And now, granted, you know, I mean, it wasn't a terrible grade. But the point I'm making here is that, you know, did I, it's one thing to say it in class. I'm talking about what you're getting graded on. I'm talking about what they're going to be. So I'm just saying, don't let them, you got to be smart. You got to pick your battles. And in law school, you know, I don't want all the top conservative minds in the country either kept out of top law schools because they're failing classes on campuses because of the progressives that are grading them, or in law school, I don't want people to be excluded from top jobs, clerkships, etc., because they're trying to take a stand. So that's where I am on that. I just wanted to say, and I know you got to be a little sneaky. This is CIA Buck speaking to you now. You got to pick your battles. You can't be, you know, you got to keep your shield high, but, you know, you can't fight all the time. Sometimes you gotta keep that shield by your your side in case, and then you pull it out. All right, team, I'm going to run over to CNN right now. Have a fantastic weekend. Please download the podcast and forget about what I said about not only having your shield high, because you know you must have your shield high.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.